Well, that's a nice segue to introduce our speaker. For those of you who are not finance people, MFA is not the Museum of Finance, Fine Arts. It is Moody Familetto and Familetti and Andromico.
So there's a button on our website, just so you know, Larry, that you can push, and it says the names. And so when I was interviewing 4 years ago with this firm, I actually probably pushed that button about 20 times till I got it right. It's Moody, Familetti, and Andromico.
Yeah, but right. If you put it into your website, trying to find the website, you're going to end up with the MFA.
As I was saying, MFA.
Exactly.
They have 100 professionals and 17 partners. And Tracy is a lead partner for the company's public company practice. She's got over 20 years' experience in public accounting and corporate finance. Her industry experience includes manufacturing, retail, construction, oil and gas, technology, life sciences, and professional services. She's been past president of the American Women's Society of Certified Public Accountants, and she's vice chair of the Massachusetts affiliate of the Susan G. Komen for the Cure. So I'm going to have Tracy put this mic on and give the show to her.
All right. Thank you very much, Larry. A little bit more background so you understand that 20 plus years. I actually am a KPMG and Pricewaterhouse alum, and then I went into industry and worked at Cabot Corporation, Houghton Mifflin, Varian Semiconductor, and then decided to get back into public accounting with smaller firms, if you will. So I've spent my entire life working with or for public companies, large and small. So, and it's, I hate to say, almost 25 years now. Today we are here to talk about the audit committee trends and how to manage your CPA firm. So I hope that's a topic that you find of interest. And because this is a seat at the table, I am actually looking for a lot of interaction. I feel, because I'm sitting at the front of this table, that there might be a little bit of a barrier with this empty space in front. But hopefully Ellen is going to help, because I know she's quite engaging, and so I'm going to possibly put her on the spot a bit if other people...
Some of us are not so quiet.
That's good to know. So I actually first want to start with the fact that the audit committee is traditionally a standing committee of the board of directors. So by extension, it is part of the board of directors. And so when we think about audit committee trends, we also need to look at what's happening from a trend perspective for boards. And what we are finding now is that we are coming into a new relationship era, where companies are engaging in different relationships with customers, employees, investors, their communities, and boards need to mirror the way companies are engaging. And so we are seeing that peripherally. And so my first survey question for you is, how many of you have ever been on a board or on a board, whether it's a public, a private, or a not-for-profit? Raise your hands. Great. Excellent. So my next question for you is, based upon what you're seeing, those of you who are engaged right now, what is a board of the 21st century looking and feeling like to you today? And if you want to compare and contrast it to what it looked like 5 years ago, 10 years ago, even 20 years ago, what are you seeing on boards today in the 21st century? And I'm going to put Ellen on the spot, and if you have some thoughts.
I have a lot of thoughts. So the question is, I'm not sure which angle you're trying to get to, because you could go maybe that question up about 10 different ways. I think if you were to go 15 years ago versus now, in terms of, you know, seriousness, liability, concern, how, you know, board members, you know, 15 years ago, board members would show up, and you're lucky if they cracked their book before they walked in the room, right? I'm exaggerating a little, but, you know, now everybody, at least everybody I know, gets it. It's a real job. It's a real focus. Think about things. You know, so that to me is a big change.
So there's a recent survey, to Ellen's point, that actually says for public company board of directors, they spend on average 236 hours a year on activities associated with their board seat. So that is, you know, definitely, you're absolutely right. There's more time spent in the board meetings, more time doing the review of the board package ahead of time, committee responsibilities, even representing the organization externally in some form or fashion. Yes. Sorry.
I would go same. You know, 15 years ago, boards were public companies were basically CEOs of other public companies. Today, they don't have the time to do that because they got to run their own company. So you're going to find the boards of more retired CEOs of other public companies because boards of public companies don't like their CEOs sitting on other boards because that takes because of the amount of time required now, takes their time away from the company they're supposed to be focused on.
So is that good or bad?
I think that's good.
Because?
In the end, your CEO is responsible for his company. Your board is responsible for making sure the CEO is doing his job. Time away from, you know, because of the time requirements being involved in another public company. And again, I was a former investment banker, so I was sitting with these boards during mergers and acquisitions negotiations where boards, you know, you had a bunch of CEOs who basically were, you know, in there for, you know, 3, 4, 5 days in a row. That's a lot of time away from their own company. So I think it's to some extent better that it's more retired or senior people like Ellen or others in this room who have independent practices so we can afford the time than for an active CEO to be in that position.
So I have I agree with you, but I have a variation of thought on this. It used to be a lot more active CEOs. I agree with you that that's changed. But what seems to be now is that companies will say, not that the sitting CEO of their company can't sit on another board, it's that they can only sit on one.
Right.
So they still let them sit.
No, I agree with that.
So for exactly the reason you said, right, there's restricted, therefore the board diversity has been changing.
Yeah.
But I think it's mostly been changing, not just because of the time required, but also because of the needs have changed. I mean, if you look at the big trends over what the real issues are at the board today, you know, it's cybersecurity, it's social media, it's probably all the things you're going to talk to us about. And boards in reaction are saying, oh God, do we need somebody with a specialty in that, whatever that is, on the board, forgetting they can always bring in an expert to come in as a, you know, to consult. Anyway, a lot of that is taking time up at the board, particularly at the nominating and governing side.
So Ellen, you bring up a good point. There is a trend towards bringing specialists onto the board, not just having those CEOs or retired CEOs. What other trends are you seeing out there on the boards that you're on now that you didn't see in the past?
Well, I think board governance has become a major, major issue. So boards are much more activists. They're required. They have to organize themselves to be more effective in terms of their interaction with the management of the company. So board governance is a big, big thing now. You know, I'm a chair of a finance committee of a reasonable size nonprofit, and I have now been on that board for 12 years, and at some point they're going to phase me out, like soon. Back at the beginning, you know, getting information or being responsive to some of the concerns of the organization is very tough. Just we weren't well enough organized, we weren't well enough, and the managers, you know, original founders of the charity, you know, aren't used to having a board help manage the organization. But today, as I look what's going on, governance is a big issue. We focus on a whole bunch of risks to the organization. We're international, we're in 65 countries, we're in 50 states.
Enterprise risk management.
It's you know, all the things that Larry's been teaching us here have all been relevant to, you know, my experience on this board. I have one member of my committee who just is firing off emails to the CEO about every 3 weeks because he's upset about something.
So what makes a great board? Oh, go ahead, Larry, sorry.
You know, if I focus this on nonprofits,
yes,
I'm seeing a really big shift between, I would say, boomers and the next generation coming up. When you look at people my age, many people would get on boards of nonprofits because it's good for business, you know, it'll be good for my resume, it's good for business development, and the real goal is you should not fall asleep with your nose in the coffee. That's really gauche, and you should write a check once a year.
And after and a check once a year.
Short of drowning in your soup and failing to write a check, that's really about all that was expected. What I'm seeing with younger people, and I think Bill Gates is sort of symbolic of this, is a kind of an attitude of, I'm a very busy person, I do not have a lot of time to fuck around. So if I'm going to get involved in your board, I'm going to really get involved. I'm not going to put in an appearance. I'm really going to get involved. And again, I think Bill Gates is a very good example, because there are not many physicians in the United States that know more about childhood diseases in the third world than Bill Gates. He could have done anything. He decided to focus on one thing. And I find a lot of young people, when they look at boards, they want to know, are you serious? Or are you just screwing around? Are you just wanting a check? Or you really want me? Mm-hmm. And that was not a question in my generation, but it is in younger's. That's what I'm finding.
They want to experience the mission. And they want to experience the philanthropic part of being part of a not-for-profit in a different way than our generation. And even in doing fundraising at the not-for-profit level, you have to understand that, because it's not only at the board level, it's in getting contributors and people to get engaged with a not-for-profit organization at all levels, that we're seeing that absolutely, which is I think wonderful. Wonderful. So what makes a great board? This side of the room's been talking a lot. How about this side of the room?
Well, I'll
okay.
So I've joined these two boards in the last 3 years, and they're both unique situations in that I wasn't like joining a board that already existed. They're both newly created. Both cases, everybody that's there is there for a real reason. So you've got a bunch of people, 7 on one board, 5 on the other, that each have a different skill set and bring something to the board. And so for one, the one that was a startup, I wasn't interviewed by the board because the board didn't exist. I was interviewed by the management company that was starting the fund, which is kind of rare these days. You're interviewed by the board. There were two inside trustees for that fund board that interviewed me. So there were two people there that were going to be on the board. But when they invited me to join, I said I wanted to be one of the other three. You know, there were going to be three independent trustees. I was one. I wanted to meet one of the other two to see if the chemistry was right. Now, I was the only one that management didn't know from a previous life. So I was sort of the odd man out. They all knew each other, but you know, I hadn't really met them. But they all brought a very unique skill set to that board. So it was, you know, nobody was somebody's golf buddy or dentist or not that I have a brother dentist, so I'm not a dentist, but so I think, you know, looking at that, everybody is there and bring the skill set to it. And I think maybe a little bit what, you know, from my career being in public accounting like you, I think maybe when, and I don't mean to be self-serving when I say this, but, you know, when the requirement came up to have an audit committee financial expert on the board, you know, and which was part of Sarbanes-Oxley and in response to all these big, you know, a lot of technology, not technology, communication company problems, fraud, and stuff like that. From my point of view, when I was the audit partner, that made my life a lot easier. And a lot, I know people don't like Sarbanes, but, you know, there were some, like everything, there's good and there's bad pieces. And that really made my life easier because now I reported to the board, to the audit committee. And it gave me, if there was pressure on me as the auditor from management, it gave me a place to go. That was supposedly, you know, independent. And so I think that maybe started to, people started saying, well, you know, this has worked out pretty well. Maybe it wasn't that conscious. So now we're worried about cybersecurity, or we're worried about supply chain management or something. Let's get somebody whose career was focused on that. They didn't necessarily have to be the CEO. You can't get that many CEOs anyway now because companies will only let their CEO sit on one. And you got more variety and diversity of backgrounds. Maybe not everybody ran a company, but they were big contributors and pieces of the puzzle. I think maybe that changed things.
When the last time I was on board at the C level as a CFO, it was really important, and we were right at the beginning of that. It was right at the end of the dot-com bubble burst. And what was really important to me on the board was approachability. Since it wasn't helpful to me if people just came in and barked at me, and looked at the numbers once a quarter when we met. It was more important that I could pick up the phone and ask them if I had a problem and dialogue honestly about it, so that I had people that had a kind of shared and collective wisdom, and people that had and done my job or had friends or colleagues that had done my job, people that could actually help me, not just proffer an opinion and look good in front of one another. So the board members that were best at giving advice and listening, that honestly truly wanted to help, not just just look good or yell at people, those were the ones that I really found valuable. So to me, it made my job easier, made me more effective.
Probably on the same theme, but the word I use, it's overused, is independence. It's one thing to be an independent director and so designated on a public company or a venture-backed company. It has certain connotation or even certain direct meaning. But in the real broader sense, it's the independence that gives you the give that board member the both the capacity and the license to behave the way you're describing. Some consultative when needed, certainly disinterested when needed, and objective. It counteracts the bias you might have with some that are maybe some of the hangover type of board members, hangover of another generation, if you will. Attitude, not generation necessarily. I'm in that generation, but
not
you know what I mean. it counteracts attitudes that might have a certain amount of bias. It certainly counteracts if you're on a private board. I know as the independent director on a private venture board, you're always working about, okay, an exit plan is nice, but perhaps we should also be thinking about this. So that independence just, I think, adds something to every board.
I would agree. I think it's a very important component. You know, if you're a member of a professional board organization like NACD, you've probably been engaged in some of these topics that we've been talking about now. So when we think about the boards of today, you know, they are clearly taking a new approach that represents the values of the company and the communities that they serve. And they're all, the boards are also making sure that they're more diverse, they're more transparent, they're more trusted, they're more connected, and they're more engaged. And I read a quote that I thought was really good. It's oversight, insight, and foresight, which means substance, thinking, and to you, both of your points, dialogue, making sure that you have the dialogue. And in those areas, making sure you have collaboration, willingness to do what's best for the organization, good corporate governance, to your point, making sure that they're adding value, to your point, Larry, making sure that they're proactively engaged, understanding new legislation, what's going on in the economy, how it impacts their industries as well as their company, preparing for acts of God, making sure you have a disaster recovery, and worried about new technologies. We've got cybersecurity and, you know, all of that associated with it, succession planning. And the latest and greatest now is mitigating board information risks, which I read an article recently the NACD put out, which I thought was very fascinating. So all of these things are, you know, what we see boards focusing on from a trend perspective, and as well as being best-in-class boards. I want to shift the conversation now that we've talked about boards, because all of this is an extension then and comes into play when we think about audit committees. And so I have another survey question for you. How many of you have been or are on an audit committee? Raise your hands. Okay. So let me ask you this. In your organization, why does the committee exist? What's the committee's mandate? Is it a requirement? Is it, you know, so that you've got that finance expert or experts? Is it you're raising the bar a bit? Is it to perception is everything? Why do you have an audit committee? Go ahead, Ellen.
Well, in public company, it's required.
Not if it's a small public company, though.
All right, the public company, fair enough. I guess I don't think large public company.
Which isn't a bad thing.
Which isn't a bad thing, but it's... So it's been required in all the companies I've been in. But there is, what's interesting to me is, there are some things that every audit committee is required to do. Whether it's the oversight on, you know, reporting and taxes and, you know, there's a whole list, if you will, of the sort of financial, fiscal responsibility things you do. And then there's a separate list of things that are sometimes in the audit committee, sometimes in another committee, sometimes at the full board. And so, for example, IT. I mean, historically, IT was always part of the audit committee. Now, in many companies, it's being separated out into its own committee. Sometimes it's at the full board. Enterprise risk management. I mean, I used to be a big advocate that had to be full board, and people would look at me like I had three eyes. And now the trend has gone to the full board, which is, you know, it's the risk of the whole company. It's not just an audit issue. So every company is going to be a little different. They're going to be the ones where you required an audit. There are going to be certain things that are absolutely going to be the same. And there are going to be variations depending on the industry, the makeup of the board, and where people want to focus their time.
Anybody else have a different reason why their audit committee exists?
I'd have to say it's, you mentioned perception and that sort of thing. I think it's an awful lot about it is validation and setting, clearing the way for whatever is going to come next, trying to be generalized and just not be so specific about a private company, but really it's also maturing. I mean, it's just simply to get to a certain point, your banking relations, your outside other relations with suppliers and everything else, there's an expectation of some evidence of that maturing.
Of making sure you're maintaining internal controls as well as corporate governance.
There could be an inference there, so it's not as substantive if you're doing it for that reason.
Sure.
But, you know, the nature of the beast is that it has to be substantive once you take that step.
Right. Right. So what makes a good audit committee? Just like what makes a good board, what makes a good audit committee?
Well, I definitely find having an audit chair who's very engaged, who wants to understand, what's going on. A lot of the things that pop up, cybersecurity for us as a bank, regulatory concerns, having people come in and when you have a concern, being able to go to them. So I think a lot of it comes from who's the chair. What kind of direction they're taking the committee in.
Does having members of the audit committee, having more than one member of the audit committee that is a financial expert, is that beneficial?
Well, I think you have to some extent, because the first foremost role of the audit committee is work with the auditors. So you gotta know what the auditor is doing, so it helps to be an auditor yourself. Chair of our organization, who just retired from our board, was a CPA, ran her own private practice, mostly for wealthy families or small companies. And so she was very up to speed as to what the auditors were talking about. I've served on audit committees. I'm a financial jockey, so why I'm not a CPA, I generally pass for one, but it's you need for that function, which is quality of the numbers. Okay, you got to have somebody who really knows how to do an audit to make sure that your CFO isn't pulling a fast one on you somehow. Beyond that, I go back to risk management as being an area, so you probably ought to have one or two members who more risk focused rather than pure numbers focused in a good audit committee. I think that's the second
diversity function. Diversity.
Yeah, exactly.
I think when audit committees first kind of came together, there was a concept that anything that involved a number was covered by the audit committee. And as people got more used to what an audit committee would do, what an audit really was, that other issues like compliance and regulatory and risk, enterprise risk management, that there are a lot of other risks besides financial risk and audit risk in every company. And that was something maybe that people thought, oh, the audit committee takes care of all those number things. And then they're like, well, wait a minute, audit committee is primarily focused on external financial reporting, internal management reporting. There's, how do we keep track of, how do we determine how much we're paying people? So they have compensation committees, because that became, all these things kind of like, there's more things that, you had that time when people were backdating options. And it's like, is that a compensation issue or an audit issue? Or what, is choppy water?
Or a legal issue.
or a legal issue.
Yeah, yeah. So, I think, that it helped to, a good audit committee looks at a lot of different things. And some things, mm-hmm. They might be different committees depending on the company and on the type of companies that I am on. And I'm the chair of both audit committees. We also look at valuation and regulatory compliance, and spend a lot of time with the CCO. We might also, we spend a lot of time with the service providers, that most of the systems are outsourced. So, you do, it's a lot of extra work.
A lot depends on whether the board has both a finance committee and an audit committee, as our board does. All right. I actually can't serve on our audit committee because, as the case of most nonprofits, your treasurer has to be a member of the board, can't be a manager. So I'm the treasurer of the organization. That automatically disqualifies me from the audit committee. because I'm an officer of the company, but it's interesting how we divide our roles. The audit committee does look at the risk management, looks at the works with the account auditor, works with the CFO in terms of the whole audit process, okay? The finance committee, we worry about the budget, compliance with the budget. We worry about with our development committee, revenue ready, you know, where's the revenue coming from? How much risk are we willing to take in terms of setting a personnel budget for our organization? So we divide the numbers functions into two different committees. As chair of the finance committee, I sit as ex officio on the audit committee. I will participate in their meetings, but I have no vote, so it's...
Yes, Larry.
Let me ask you a question. You serve as a partner of the CPA firm working with audit committees.
Yes.
Are there any questions that the members of the audit committee have not been asking you that you wish they had?
It is a very good question, and you know, specifically when I'm dealing with public company audit committees or their board of directors if they don't have audit committees, we're required by the PCAOB as well as the AICPA to communicate certain things to the audit committees. So I have the required communications that we do in the full audit committee, and then when we go into executive session, I take that as my clue, or cue, if you will, that this is a discussion that's open, and they may ask open-ended questions, Larry, like, is there anything that you'd like to tell us? And typically, we've teed up what we want to talk to them about. If the audit did not go well, we actually, before those meetings, sort of take a look at that. And I'm always willing to say in the audit committee there are some things we didn't do that we could have done differently, especially when you're dealing with management. If it's a new engagement and you're really just getting to know management and their communication style, there may have been some things that because you didn't realize that they would prefer to communicate in email versus over the phone or vice versa. Or there was miscommunications, or the CFO is much more of a black and white guy. And so when you thought you'd covered something, you really hadn't covered it because you hadn't covered it the way he liked it to be covered. So then there was miscommunications. But if the audit didn't go well, we also look at what could have been done better on the client side. And because it's the audit committee's job to manage the relationship with the CPA firm and the audit, they need to know those things. They need to know if we're getting information late. They need to know if the information we are getting is not accurate and not complete. They need to know if how much additional assistance we're having to give to the resources. This is all part of the audit committee's responsibility to make sure that they've got the bench strength in the finance group in order to be able to do the accounting close and the financial reporting. I mean, that is their mandate and their responsibility, and it's one of their top priorities. And so it's our responsibility, because you're right, Larry, we see a lot, to communicate those observations to them, and we try to do that. If we don't get asked to go into an executive session, I typically ask if we can. And that sort of is the cue to the audit committee that we have some things that we need to communicate. You know, part of our conversation, which we're running out of time, so I'm gonna try to get to that, is managing your CPA firm. Go ahead, Ellen.
Well, I just wanted that executive session because what I've always done is, you know, we have the audit committee, then we have our own, we have an executive session which includes just the audit firm, the external audit firm.
Yep.
Without management. Then we have a session with management. And then we have our own session without the auditors. And then we have our own session.
Yep.
This is a regular.
This is standard.
Yeah.
So that it's like there's always a
session. We always have an executive session. And when I was in your shoes, I thought for my clients, I was saying, just for the record, it's good to have that you had this
right.
time alone. And if they didn't
right.
ask for it, I would tell them they should have it, and I wanted it.
Right.
Because I wanted to make sure that everybody had the opportunity
right.
to say something when the financial staff wasn't there. And I think a good board also excuses the auditors and talks to the CFO.
Exactly. So you have
and
it both
says,
ways.
You know, what do you really think of these
right.
guys?
So
right.
your executive sessions would be regular, not on an as-needed basis.
No, regular.
Right.
With a regular, yeah. For a public company,
twice a year, Larry.
Okay.
Well, for a public company, we're required to communicate with the audit committee 5 times a year. It's every quarter, it's for planning for the audit, and it's the completion of the audit.
Right.
So we're having 5 executive sessions.
So we're saying all saying the same thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the interesting
absolutely.
Thing is both we're in different industries
right.
and,
yeah.
and we do the same thing. So
yeah.
I don't know how much of a trend that it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. When I look at an audit committee, a great audit committee. It is an audit committee. All the things that we talked about here, that they're the finance experts, they understand complex accounting transactions. So when you're talking to them about the fact that you just entered into a contract that now you're going to have to bifurcate out a derivative and now you're going to have that fair valued on a regular basis, they know what that means. It's not like, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, so you can have that meaningful conversation with them. And it's also the diversity that you need in order to, if the mandate of the audit committee is to also be working with risks, that you've got that diversity so they can do that. You know, when you think about the trends of an audit committee and what we're seeing, we talked about some of these things. Managing and owning the relationship with the independent auditors, that's critical. That you as the audit committee should be managing that. Having oversight over financial reporting and internal controls, and less and less risk management, because to Ellen's point, it's either at the full board or you've got these other subcommittees now that are being developed to assess those risks, whether it's IT risks or you know, any of these other risks out there. Also leading practice and trends that we're seeing is higher levels of communication and interaction with the internal auditors, management, and other standing committees of the board. To Ellen's point, where you've got little bits and pieces that are now residing in other committees, but they all overlap, and you all have to have, you know, you think of the circles, you know, you all have to be communicating with each other. And so we're seeing that as a trend. There's more focus on the importance of committee composition and dynamics, making sure that you've got the right people there, that you are collaborative, that you are asking the right questions of everybody, not just the external auditors. And then there's more focus on orientation, education, self-assessment, evaluation, and executive sessions, asking what the group can do better, what the company can do better, what your external auditors can be doing better. We actually welcome that feedback of what can we do better. I mean, after every single quarter, I sit down with my engagement team and say, okay, what could we have done better? Because you can always do something better. And most of the time it boils down to communication. How and the personality style of communication. I can't communicate the same way with you that I communicate with you, because you both have different communication styles. So it's really important for our engagement team to understand what those communication styles are. I'll give an example. We just went to a new portal for our engagements where you load everything. Gone are the days that you give your auditors a binder, a hard copy of all the information, and gone are the days where you email all the information electronically to your auditors. You now have portals, highly secure portals, where you can put information, and it's a back and forth. And this new portal it's awesome. It's wonderful. And either our clients love it or they hate it. And if they hate it, it's because they're procrastinators, because it tells you exactly where you are in the audit process, in loading information, requested information.
They haven't done their reconciliation.
And they haven't, if they haven't done it, it's right there in black and white. They cannot, the controller can no longer snow the CFO that, yes, I'm on target to get everything in that portal, because the CFO can get in there and he can see that's just not true. Additionally, there's ways to communicate instead of with emails in this portal, specifically to the spreadsheets or the documents that that are being discussed, so that there is an audit trail, or there is documentation of, you gave us this document, we're giving it back to you because it doesn't foot or cross foot, it's not complete. That information is all in there, and so our clients love that, because then they know, oh, okay, that I need to do something with. Or they absolutely hate it because they don't like social media and they feel that that's like social media for them. So it's very fascinating.
Well, they just don't want their mistakes highlighted.
Well, who knows? But, you know, in that case, we have to, again, back to communication. We have to engage, we have to educate our engagement teams, which are these, you know, young professionals who are very savvy with social media. That, you know, just pick up the damn phone. Ask the question. You know, get up out of your seat, out of your conference room, and walk into the CFO or the controller's office, and just ask the question. Don't post it in this portal. Just, you know, ask the question. So it's sort of fascinating that way. So I've got 10 minutes by my count. So I want to transition to the second phase of this program, which is managing your CPA firm. And so whenever I think about managing the CPA firm, I have a survey question for you, though. How many of you feel you do manage the CPA firm, your CPA firm? If you're on the audit committee, how many of you feel you manage the CPA firm?
You mean manage or manage well?
Yeah, right. That's a good point.
Let's start with manage. Manage well.
One better than the other. Yeah, it depends on.
Right. Right. How many of you feel that the CPA firm is actually managing you? No? That's good. That's really good. I was actually assuming, incorrectly, I guess, that there was going to be some folks that would raise their hand. Because typically when, you know, somebody expresses to me that they feel like their CPA firm is managing them, they probably are. And if that's the case, you need to ask yourselves, why is that? What could be done differently? To sort of make sure that you are managing your CPA firm. You know, we talked about the executive sessions, we talked about the timing of the setting up the meetings for the required communications. For most of my clients, we're fairly proactive in establishing those and asking the client to please set those up, as opposed to the audit committee sort of saying, this is when we want to have them, please put them on your calendar. I would welcome an audit committee that would say, here's when we're having our audit committee, please put them on the calendar. You know, that helps my life to know those things well in advance.
But I think it's a process issue, and it's...
It is.
And whether the audit committee is reactive to your proposed schedule, or they already, if it's a good board, good public board, they've got their board meetings scheduled out for the entire year going into the year. Right. So you absolutely, you'll absolutely know when those are. You will know when the audit committee's meeting. You just schedule yourself into those meetings. It's a bi-directional.
It absolutely thing. Is.
If you're training a young company, like, you know, the couples that you're chairing of, you may want to set the process so that they understand what the expectations are. So yes, you have to manage the committee, especially for young companies. But if you're on a traditional large company board, the system is already there.
It's like clockwork, yeah.
I don't want to micromanage it as a board member.
Yeah.
But, you know, for example, on the smaller startup, first set of financials, they asked me, do you want to look at the early drafts? And I said, oh, no. That's for you and the partner. I said, I will read the last draft of the financials.
Right.
On the other larger board, I don't look at the financials before they get published because there isn't that need.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I said, look, you know, we worked out the details. You do it. Call me anytime.
Right.
Either the partner or the CFO if there's a problem. And if I'm worried about something or I see something in the paper, I'll email them, either one of them. On both the boards, I meet with the CFO and the audit partner between board meetings separately.
Sometimes that's important.
Sometimes it's together, but it's always separate. Sometimes it's at a conference, it's social, you know. But in between meetings to, you know, and sometimes there's something that we've got our eye on one of the things and that you're kind of watching. You want to wait a whole quarter to get, you know, the report on how they're dealing with something. So.
Some of the
I just want to say one, the single best question I was ever asked as a audit partner by a board member, and this was very first audit committee meetings, it was a long time ago. I was a young partner, and you know, they always have to talk about managing here, who's managing who here. And this guy was a venture capitalist, and he's you know, gone, retired, I know he's gone. Anyway, his name is Byard Henry, and he's a great, great guy, one of the best board members I've worked with. And he would always ask, he said, are you doing the best you can to keep the fee down? You know, we would talk about that. And then he would look, and he said, and are you being paid enough to do a good job? And that's something that I think, as a board member, you want to make sure that your audit committee, you know, the lowest fee is not always the best, and that's true for a lot of service providers. You want to get the best value for what you're getting. So you talk about who's managing who, and you know, you talk about we approve, board members approve the audit fee, we hire the auditors. You got to make sure that they're fairly compensated, you know, one way or the other. And a lot of times, my experience was there's a lot of focus on reducing that fee. That's fair, you know, but you can't reduce it so much that. And you want to make sure you get a good value for it. Having these interactions in between and stuff is...
I think the communication, you're absolutely right, the communication is absolutely critical. Obviously making sure that independence is maintained, but making sure that you build the relationship and the independence. You know, the fee is absolutely a really good point to bring up. Primarily because most of the time in the accounting profession, we give a fixed fee quote. That fixed fee quote presumes an inordinate amount of
proper company work.
Proper company work, right. Making sure that we get it when the timelines are established. You betcha, you betcha, because it helps us to document back to the company the additional fees that we have to charge. I would much rather have an audit fee where I've got a little bit of cushion when that happens, so I don't have to go back and charge. You know, in that case. But when this profession right now, especially in this environment with the economy, I mean, you know, it's very competitive. And so we just had this discussion recently with a CEO because we had to talk to him about the third quarter in a row that we're having to give him an additional fee because things weren't put in timely, they weren't complete, they weren't accurate, and we had
his CFO was on the hot seat at that point.
And yes, and we had the conversation with the audit committee, and I let them know that if this continues, we will continue to bill you for these things. And so, you know, if whatever you can do to address this, and talked about different things that they could do and so forth. So you're absolutely right. And so I'm very proactive, and as I would hope most in our profession are in about talking about the fees, mm-hmm. And making sure that, you know, we are compensated. We feel we add value. we don't just give an audit. We make sure that our opinion is given so that you can be assured that there is not a material misstatement in your financial statements. And with the complex accounting rules and regulations out there, that is a tall order. And it costs us money from a regulatory regulation perspective, professional standards perspective, for the amount of documentation we have to do to be able to then just render, you know, that opinion. So
that's why in an M&A transaction, the first thing you want to know is you want to see the auditor doing in the final due diligence round. You want to see the work papers.
Mm-hmm.
Because you now know how well the numbers got scrubbed.
Right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So we've talked a little bit about the trends. We've talked about managing your CPA firm. Does anybody else have anything that they'd like to add about managing your CPA firm? Or
well, the first one, sorry.
That's okay.
So one of the curiosities that I have is that as we really move to more and more data and information being really core to running companies, are you all seeing a shift in terms of the amount of importance being placed on data governance and data quality? I mean, nobody really brought it up here, but the whole concept of data as an asset, place I play in, right, is would seem to be critical with the kinds of businesses that we're running these days. We're making less and less products, and it's more and more about, you know, digital products and things that don't exist in the 3D world. So I would imagine that that's going to become more and more of a concern. And is that falling still under the audit committee? Or are we starting to see the formation of separate committees for really understanding what's going on with companies' systems and their data?
Ellen, you are on three boards, three very diverse boards. What are you seeing?
I guess I'm trying to understand exactly what your question is. Your question about IT and the IT systems and the protection of the data within the company?
And there's a cybersecurity issue associated with that, because in the environment.
Apart from that, you mentioned that. So I'm saying apart from that.
Okay.
These days, you know, the kind of calls and inquiries that I get are related to the quality of the data. Not, I get the breach and the security, but just the data that businesses are basing information on, and decisions, big decisions on, and it's deeper and deeper concern as data is moving faster and faster and the velocity is increasing, the volume, that nobody's really looking at.
So you're talking about external data, not internally generated data?
It could be both.
I mean, one of the problems in financial services is you've got all these disparate systems that don't really talk to each other very well. So you may have an equity system and a fixed income system. You've got a trading system that's different than the fund accounting system. It's different than the external reporting system. And then you want, somebody says, well, you know, what's our exposure to China? Well, which system do you want me to get it off of?
Right.
And it's got five different answers for you here.
Right.
You know, do you want trade date or settlement date? So it's all this about data governance. What is the, you know, can we narrow down the amount of data that we have so that it's, you know, and that it's really reliable and we know where we're getting it from? So it's not, we get that from Mary Lou's system.
And what's the process for determining single source of truth for data? What's the game plan for?
Sometimes it's definitional.
Yeah.
You know, and define when you get asked this question, what are the parameters of it?
And you should be concerned. Because one of the things that we're seeing is that, you know, with the rise of data stewards, your CDOs, chief data officers and stuff, still not seeing the adoption of those types of structures inside companies that we'd expect to see, given the scary things we see, you know, on the other end when systems, you know, go bad or data goes bad or there's a major failure or there's some critical information, critical decision that's based on bad information. So just not seeing it. So it's kind of interesting that nobody brought it up here. So.
Well, so I'm thinking of it because most of my companies are what I call product companies.
Or
mm-hmm.
what?
Product companies.
Budget.
The product. So there's whether it's a technology-based product, a consumer-based product, but it's a product. And I guess most of the time where we get focused on the data quality is in what I call definitional. Mm-hmm. You know, when we talk about a box of numbers or sources of numbers, we define what it is we're trying to look for in a way that is just very well defined. Mm-hmm. So we spend a lot of time on that. That still doesn't get to your issue, though.
How is the company structuring itself to look at their data as an asset? How are they governing themselves? Just like you go into, as an audit committee, I think you go into looking, you know, okay, I have a CFO, a controller, how many junior accounts do you have? How do you process? You know, how many days to close? What kind of, you know, ERP system are you using? But we're also seeing that as data is being shared, part numbers, customer master data, you know, even compliance information, all your issues with data privacy that you have. What's your system, what's your structure inside the corporate structure to manage these issues?
Well, so here's an example, because I happen to know three of the board members of TJX very well, so I end up in these conversations.
I used to work for them.
And they, okay, and so they spend a lot of time, you know, on the whole management of the customer data. And so there's certainly a big focus at the board level about data in terms of customer data. Of course, it's now even more now that they had that whole breach. But even before, though, it was always to understand the customer. Is that what you're, because that is an asset.
Yeah, that is, and that's one of their assets. So that would be a good example of that. And understanding if they're sharing data, each organization shares data differently.
Right.
They share it across multiple systems and platforms. How are they deciding? Show me your structure for how you make decisions about conflicts between people that own data. How often, how do you manage your data quality? How do you monitor your data quality? Those are pretty significant.
See, most of my companies, the focus is on the IP as the protection, right? That's which is a little bit different.
So I would
say, working with our public.
We're going to have to stop in about 3 minutes. Okay. Just one.
So I would say, you know, one of the focuses we have when working with the external auditors, and it's our own internal, what we do as well, but, you know, the internal controls over financial reporting, you know, the systems that information is being pulled from, they're asking the questions, how do you know that information is right? What controls do you have for the information going in, the information coming out, that the systems are speaking to each other? So those are questions they're asking from a financial reporting. And then we ask ourselves as internal auditors on anything we do, is the customer information. And like you said, you can have several systems that have the same information. And there is a focus on making sure, you know, I think it's not just now, but making sure all of those systems are talking to each other, the information is complete, and, you know. And so I think, yeah.
I guess I'll add one little twist, and maybe this gets back to your very first question about how everything's different, because it ties into your last question.
Mm-hmm.
That is that versus 15 or 20 years ago, think about how global relatively small businesses are compared to them. 15 or 20 years ago, it just wasn't. There were a handful of mega firms that were truly global.
Mm-hmm.
Rather small firms are truly global.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is they have to deal with all of the issues of different time zones for valuing things, very different settlement protocols in different markets. So they're no longer his data, because data follows many different conventions according to the local environment. And then to try to, you know, integrate all of that in an efficient way, I think, is a problem that didn't exist in the past.
I think we just stumbled upon a trend.
Yeah.
That we're going to see more and more
of. I see it at the bottom.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking, I don't think corporations really understand.
Mm-hmm.
The board really understands the risks.
If I could add, for me the most important question to ask the audit committee, to the CPA firm, is this question: what questions have we not asked that we should have asked?
Right.
Not everybody is as diligent as Tracy, and she'll come in with this. This is what I want you to know. You know, we all know partners are afraid of their clients or afraid of losing the business. And they know what they want their clients to know, but unless the client asks, they're not gonna, they don't wanna tread.
Mm-hmm.
And so by asking the question, what questions have we not asked that we should have asked, that forces the hand of the partner to reveal what he or she was wanting to say and waiting for you to ask the right question.
Very good.
So thank you very much.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, everybody. This was wonderful. Appreciate the feedback.
For those of you who wish to leave, you're welcome to leave. For those of you who wish to stay and continue talking with Tracy, you're welcome to do so. Our meeting next month is going to be on the topic of